in a paper yesterday in Spokane, there was a picture of Sarah Knox, and she was 119 years old, and she died Thursday. She was 20 years old when the 20th century began. I mean, that's just remarkable. Guinness Book of World Records, they had listed her as the oldest person on Earth. To get in the records, you have to be able to document it in some way, not just claim to, you know, some people feel that old and have made claims, but she had documentation apparently as well. One of the church members in Lubbock, where we were before we came here, was X.C. Blair. Well, she's still there. She's 102 years old. And she's asked me to perform her funeral when she died. What's amazing is that it doesn't seem to be imminent. She's made it past 100. We didn't know if she'd make it to 100. She's made it to 102, and she's still motoring on. She has had some frailties there, but when we were still in Lubbock, it was wonderful. We would go play dominoes, and she could just beat the socks off me because she could count so fast. Now, she'd played this all her life, and it was kind of humbling to sit there and have this, you know, 99-year-old person just dust you off at dominoes. But it was, we had a lot of fun there. It was a wonderful time. X.C. was born into a world that is so much different. It is so far different from what we know today. It's hard for us to really realize what it was like. We can watch movies, read stories, but it's still hard to truly go back and compare. 100 years ago, you know, obviously there were no cars in the garages, there were no planes in the air, there were no modern appliances in the kitchen. You know, what did people do without a refrigerator? You know, I've seen these little toasters you used to put over the fire, and it would burn one side before you would turn the toast over and burn the other. There were no ranges. There was no penicillin in hospitals. Now, penicillin opened up an unbelievable change in the entire medical industry. They manufactured penicillin in time to have large amounts of it before the D-Day invasion so that the Allied troops would have that to fight the infections from the wounds of battle. But it wasn't commercially available to the general public, I think, until even after that. When X.C. Blair was born, no one had yet tasted a Hershey's chocolate bar. And tuna fish was yet to be in cans. I thought that tuna was probably created that way and then was set free in the ocean as a plus. Coffee wasn't instant, and nothing else was instant either. There were no hamburgers and no hot dogs, no pizza, as we know it today. All of those things have been created in the culture that we live in. Popsicles, paper napkins, Kool-Aid, homogenized milk. If you go to the store, almost anything you would pick up on the shelf, with the exception of maybe a few vegetables, but almost anything that is there is something that has been created in the culture of which we have lived and grown up in ourselves. 100 years ago, you could not even get a chocolate chip cookie. They hadn't invented the two yet. By mixing the chocolate with the cookie, no one had ever done that. You know, that seems strange. Aluminum foil is about 50 years old. It came to be about the time of recoverable food containers invented by, of course, Earl Tupper. Invented the resealable food containers that Tupper wears, it came to be. French fries came along about that time, and McDonald's was soon to follow. The fry came first. You know which came first? The fry or the drive-in? The fry. The drive-in followed. What came first, TV or TV dinners, obviously? TV came along, and the TV dinner followed, 1954. I remember my first vision of color TV. Someone had it in their apartment, and we went over and sat down in front of it, and on the front of the TV was a large plastic sheet with three colors of plastic on the sheet over the face of a black and white TV, and that was color TV. You know, the sky was blue and the ground was, you know, brown, and the middle was kind of, maybe the middle was clear. It's been a long, long time. There weren't even microwave ovens when I went into high school. They hadn't produced those yet commercially for the market. Unbelievably, you still had to warm things up in a pan. Most of our lifestyle today, most of the things that we use, that we eat, that we are familiar with, much of our even identity and the culture has come into existence only in the last 100 years. Now, with 6,000 years of human history, for our entire culture to have come into existence in 100 years, that's dramatic. Now, we could all give thousands of examples of that, but that is very, very dramatic. And the change and the movement in that direction is even faster and faster. I bought Michelle and Megan and Derek a computer to use 2.5 years ago. It was brand new. It didn't even read 2000 when I started it up this morning. It read 1900. I bought it brand new 2.5 years ago, and it wasn't even designed to make it to this day. It had to be manually updated. Now that's unbelievable. Change, though, is so normal that we simply come to expect it. If you added up all the scientists that have ever lived in the history of mankind, you would find that 90% of them are alive today. Today, 90% of all the scientists in history. Scientific information doubles every 5 years. All other information doubles every 2.5. Scientists are close to mapping the entire genetic structure of a human being. They are already moving genes around between plants and animals. Genesis 11, we live in a time that has never existed before. Not just because time doesn't repeat itself in that way, but we live in a kind of time that has never existed before. And when humanity was approaching a time like this and could have had access to something like this, God stopped them in their tracks so that it would not advance. How long ago was the beginning, effectively, of the Industrial Revolution? 250 years. You go back 250 years, and when you go further than that by much, you find a time that in many ways is not fundamentally different from the way mankind has always lived. Now that's unbelievable. Our culture is 100 years old. The entire Industrial Revolution is only 250. The history of mankind is about 6,000. Mankind went on the same, it would seem, almost forever by our comparison. And then it changed all at once. Genesis 11, the whole earth had one language, one speech. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain, and they dwelt there. And they said, come on, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And they had brick and they had asphalt. They said, let's build ourselves a city whose tower, whose top is in the heavens. Let's make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the earth. One of the very early efforts to centrally focus and rule and control from one point. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. If they could have advanced from that point and then had the Industrial Revolution, in 250 years, they could have been sending men to the moon. That's how human history has gone. Now, I realize there's specific technological advances. The crossbow, gunpowder, there are things that took place in those years. But honestly, by the record here and by a historical observation, they could have made certain advances very quickly, and then all the rest of human history would have been brought to fruition in a very, very short time. God held them off to where they could not combine the collective human intellect, as powerful as it is, to advance the world beyond its time. The economics of what has taken place with centralization and also the information and technology that has been produced has been just as dramatic as the items themselves. We are within, in the United States, 1 month of realizing the longest economic expansion in American history. There has never been economically a finer time in this nation in terms of what is able to be produced and accomplished and shared among the population as a whole. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is at an all-time high. It is up 25% for the year. The NASDAQ Composite Index, which is the technology stocks, which is where the money now is flowing, has just passed 4,000. Do you know when it passed 3,000? 2 months ago. Can you imagine an index whose history now culminates at 4,000 and it passed 3,000 2 months ago? Three stocks in that index gained over 1,000% this year, and one stock gained over twice that in 1 year. My brother pleaded with me last spring to find some money, to take some money, and to put it into a particular technology stock that he recommended. And I just smiled at him, and we went on with our lives as they are, as yours are, as for many of us in that respect. And he just kind of looked at me with this sigh where I said, you know, this plan can't be done. I hate to go look at that stock now that he mentioned when I see what's in place, because when you see the technology stocks, it was one of those that raced ahead of many of the rest. We live in a society where things are happening so fast that it's almost beyond belief. Brother, this has never happened before. And there is fabulous wealth for some. But there is a land around us, by God's own grace and blessing, even in the midst of man's own selfish desires, that is richer and more prosperous than anything this world has ever seen. Genesis 49 is a prophecy about Joseph, and I realize that Joseph is a little broader than the way that we would look at the United States itself, but still I would like to just go back and remind us one of the prophecies God made about his people. Genesis 49, verse 1, Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." At the end, in the culmination of this part of God's plan for mankind, he said, I want to tell you what will happen overall. Verse 22, where it refers to Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough. This is an end time prophecy, a culmination of time. A fruitful bough by a well. That means the water is there so that this plant can have great growth and nurture. It doesn't have to starve out. It doesn't have to dry up. So it has all this resource to grow. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, hated him, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. His arms were made strong by God. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you, with blessings from heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and the womb. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors, up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him who is separated from his brothers. And so the prosperity is foretold. Now, U.S. News and World Report did a special article recently on the last 100 years. And do you know what they called it? They called it the American Century. The focus of the last 100 years is right here in the United States. During the last 100 years, the United States went from a population of 76 million to 274 million. Almost 200 million people in terms of growth. We went from a country of 3,000 millionaires to a country of 3.5 million millionaires in 100 years. The prosperity is beyond belief. 100 years ago, there were 800 passenger cars. Today, there's 130 million. 100 years ago, there was 10 miles of pavement. Today, there's 4 million miles. 100 years ago, 8% of homes had electricity. Now, 0.1% do not. Life expectancy in that context as well, for both men and women, increased about 30 years each. If you think about that, if the life expectancy today is 74, 76, 78, somewhere in that range, the life expectancy 100 years ago used to be 44, 46, 48. How many here in this room are over 44 to 48? Well, 100 years ago, you just weren't expected to be around it. That's unbelievable. Riches, opportunity, abundance, in so many ways. U.S. News and World Report said, at century's end, at this moment in time, America is unquestionably the world's dominant military, economic, and cultural superpower. For better or for worse, it's where we stand. In all the world, there is no one as strong and powerful. There is no one as rich and increased. And there is no one that the whole world looks to, even if they hate us, and emulates and wishes to reproduce than the United States. Where again did all that power and that wealth come from? You know, we think about our abundant farmlands and our enormous water resources and the forests and the timbers and the mineral resources of this country. And we can tend to think it's because God gave us this great land and all of these riches and resources that we have these many things. The USSR has great resources in that same way, minerals, forests, timber. They have farmland for thousands of miles, all through the Ukraine and what used to be the USSR. U.S. News didn't proclaim the Russian century. It was the American century. Of course, we had immigration. We had ready labor. The railroads, the roads, the buildings, the construction. We had immigration, cheap labor to build and to produce. We had the freedom of choice. We had capitalism itself, and all those things were important, but still, out of those choices is not where the blessings ultimately came. Our blessings came from the hand of God. We were discussing these issues as we drove down in the car, which is what I always do. I have to finish my sermon in the car, so somebody has to come up with a conclusion at least while we travel. And if you've ever been down to the border with Mexico, and many of you have, I used to live in New Mexico, and I've been in El Paso, and I've been across the border in various places, but you have to ask yourself, is there a line in the desert down there on which one side has resources and on which the other side does not? When you step across the border into Mexico and you see Juarez, Agua Prieta, when you see all of the difference and you move from high-rise construction and steel and glass buildings to literally dirt and metal and plywood shacks. Is that because the land changes, the resources change, the farmland changes? Or is that because there is a difference in the blessing that God has placed on one side of that line and not on the other? Nobody would like to lay it down that way. But historically, it is absolutely true. We came in here as we drove into Kennewick today, and there's apple orchards up lining the road as you come in, and there's just apples all over the ground. And there's apples all over the orchards, trees left there. Now, I don't know why those apples are like that, but there are so much and so many, and I know the price had a problem this year in some ways because of abundance, but we have so much production in this land that we can't even use what it is that we have. We can't even throw some of it away. There is so much grown and produced that it is unbelievable. Deuteronomy chapter 8, we produce so much food and so much product that it's hard for us even to imagine what is truly there. Deuteronomy 8, starting in verse 1, God was getting ready to bring Israel into a promised land back then. And it was a land that was described as being abundant in potential. In every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And God says, you know, I brought you through the wilderness to humble you and to prepare you. And he allowed them to hunger, and then he fed them with manna so that they would know where to look for their food. And they would know to look to God as their leader in there, to worship before him. Verse 4, your garments didn't wear out. Your feet didn't swell. So you should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore, keep the commandments of the Lord your God, walk in his ways, and fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills. There's so much dew in the Middle East that it actually recharges the water table and comes out in springs out in the desert, from which they can irrigate and which they can raise their crops. A land of wheat and barley, vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey. If you walked out through the Middle East today, you'd say, well, where is this land? Where is this that God gave them? A land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you lack nothing. When you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land that he has given you. And then with that, God gives them a warning. Now, Don and I were chatting again as we came down today, and when we were, he's in Pasadena now, and Michelle and I used to be there, but one of the things that was dramatic about a person that would come in from an international area, from a have-not country to the United States, and they come into Los Angeles because that was where our headquarters was, and so that's where we tended to meet people that were coming in. But you know what it was about Los Angeles that impressed them the most? You know, you and I think of Disneyland. We think of entertainment and all of these wonders and the lights and the entertainment. And what impressed them the most was the supermarket. When they walked into a supermarket, it almost shocked them into insensibility. They couldn't believe that there was everything that you could ever want to eat all in one place and more than you could ever consume. And she, they weren't impressed by entertainment to the point that they were impressed by the agricultural produce that was there, the blessings and the abundance. God here says, I'm bringing you into a land where there'll be everything you ever wanted if you'll obey me and let me bless you in that way. And then he goes on, verse number 11, beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you this day. Lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply, and your silver and gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied. Now, that is a description of what we have in today's economy and society that is far beyond anything Israel ever tasted. And God warns them, and we must be warned as well. He says, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness, he fed you with water and fed you with manna. And then verse 17, and you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand has gained me this wealth. That says, you shall remember me. Verse 20, as the nations which the Lord destroyed before you, so shall you perish, because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord your God. There is an incredible warning here, where God says, I will give you abundance beyond what you can even believe, but if you forget me and begin to focus on yourself, eventually God says, I will take it away. All the prosperity that we see around us and the great blessings and opportunities that are here are going to be taken away. God is in charge of his people, and God rules on this earth. and he warns us about that process that takes place when we turn our back as a people on him. Acts chapter 17 reflects on God's power and what his rule is in this earth. Acts 17 and verse 22, Paul here in Athens stood up and began to speak to the men that were there and tried to point them to God. And they had an altar there to the unknown God. And so Paul walked up and said, look, I will tell you about the God who you do not know. Verse 24, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth. He has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. If you believe that God is having a hands-off attitude toward the world today, that's not what the Bible says. We used to look at that. And in some ways, fine, God has let the world take its course. But that is not hands-off. That is still within his purposes. It says that God here has made of one blood all nations of men to dwell on the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. God is in charge. Is our focus on Satan as the God of this world? Is that how we look at the world and society? Or is our focus on the fact that God rules over the kingdoms of men? Now, there's a difference. And a book I was reading last night kind of brought that difference to mind. And I thought, how striking, because this book had nothing to do with the Church of God. And it was simply talking about God working in the history of his people, outside of our personal perspective. And then it had a list, and I wish I could have copied and really thought about that and read to you the differences that were made. But it said, if your focus is on Satan is the God of this world, now that's true, Satan's the God of this world, that's biblical, but if that's your focus, then what are you going to do? You're going to withdraw from this world, are you not? You're going to separate yourself and hide out in some respects from this society and this world and the responsibilities that are there, because that is Satan's world. Now, if your focus is on God rules over the kingdoms of men, then you're going to, in a more open way, in a more direct way, feel a responsibility to participate as God's servant in a way that your light is going to be more open to shine, because you're going to consider that you are there doing God's will and he is in charge of all. Now, I'm not saying both of those statements are not true, but it's a matter of where focus is put. If you had to describe the Church of God in many respects over the last years, which of those statements would you choose? Probably, from what I see, would be, even my own perspective, I have to admit, when I look at this, Satan is the God of this world. Get out of there. And yet God rules over the kingdom of men. The kingdoms of men. And so, I think sometimes our focus has been to withdraw, not just from the value system, but from the system itself, and not participate, and not contribute, and frankly, especially now, because we're busy, because we're tired, because we're already over-obligated and extended, that is a convenient thing to want to understand and believe, because it protects us in certain ways from maybe contributions that we could rightfully make. It was interesting. When I looked at that, it was like, this is us. This is me, in many respects. Job, chapter 12. Another reference to God and the nations and how we can look to God and his perspective. Job 12 and verse number 7. Job here is contending with some of those who are criticizing him and his perspective. He's defending himself. foot number nine, breaking into context, but still it makes its own point. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this, in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? It's just reflecting on God as being all-powerful and directly responsible for the course and direction of his plan on this earth. Does not the ear test words and the mouth taste its food? Wisdom is with aged men, and with length of days understanding. With him are wisdom and strength. He has counsel and understanding. If he breaks the thing down, it cannot be rebuilt. We're talking about God, you know, God's involvement now and God's purposes on earth. If he imprisons a man, there can be no release. He withholds the waters and they dry up. If he sends them out, they overflow the earth. Now, I realize he's speaking symbolically in some respects, not necessarily about specific circumstances, but what he's saying is God is involved and invested in a very dominant and overpowering and a directive way on this earth. And when you go back and look at God's warnings to his people, what is he saying? He is saying, I will be your God and you'll be my people, and I will invest myself in your life. Now, God is calling all men to salvation, but just not all at once. And even the circumstances that people face in this life, if they are not being called to salvation at this time, are still part of their character and of the mental processes of what will be their memories and experiences that they will one day address or face as they go on in their calling to the kingdom of God, whether it be by resurrection or simply later in this own time. It goes on, with him are strength and prudence, the deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away, plundered. He makes fools of judges. He loosens the bonds of kings and binds their waists with a belt. He leads princes away, plundered, overthrows the mighty. He deprives the trusted ones of speech and takes away the discernment of the elders. Pours contempt on princes, disarms the mighty. Uncovers deep things out of darkness, brings the shadow of death to light. Makes nations great, and he destroys them. He enlarges nations and guides them. Now, either he does or he doesn't. The Bible says he does. He makes nations great. He destroys them. He enlarges nations. He guides them. He takes away the understanding of the chief of the people of the earth and makes them wander in a pathless wilderness. They grope in the dark without light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man. God is invested in ways sometimes that we simply don't give him credit for. When Daniel went to Nebuchadnezzar and warned him about what it was that was about to come to pass, Daniel 4, maybe I can read a part of that. What was the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar was supposed to learn? He was supposed to learn not to exalt himself and think that he was some great thing, when indeed God is the only one who truly is great. Daniel 4, verse 17. This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know, here's the lesson, in order that the living may know that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men. What is our focus? Satan is the god of this world, or the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men? Both are true. But where you put your weight is going to determine what your perspective indeed will be. He gives it to whomever he will and sets over it the lowest of men. Verse 25, Nebuchadnezzar is told he would be driven from men and dwell with the beasts. Till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. Does that sound like hands off? It's not. It's hands off. Does that mean God answers every single prayer? I don't think so. Does that mean God doesn't answer any? I don't believe that either. I believe God will show mercy on whom he will show mercy, according to his own good purpose and time. And he gives it to whomever he chooses. So Nebuchadnezzar went through this incredible circumstance. Why? So that one person on the face of the earth could learn that lesson? or so that that lesson would be recorded and reinforced in our own personal lives and those whom indeed God would call. But God rules over the kingdoms of men. When our nation was founded, we recognized God's guiding hand in our affairs. Our laws were to be based on God's laws, and our freedom, above all, was the freedom to worship God openly and without constraint. I know that was applied imperfectly. I know that each of the little colonies had their own rules and restrictions, and you had to go find the one that was able to worship, would allow you to worship according to your way. But like Rhode Island was where the Sabbath keepers congregated. And other religious groups congregated in other places. But still, the ideal was that of freedom to worship God without government restriction or constraints. Religious worship was encouraged. Values were encouraged. I know imperfectly. We are humankind, and we are self-serving. But the ideal was obviously there. I want to read you something that happened in the Continental Congress in the course of establishing the Constitution and preparing for the future of the country in that time. June 28, 1787, the Constitutional Convention was in a bitter debate over how each state was to be represented in the Constitution and the new government. The small states felt threatened by the big ones. The big ones were trying to use their authority because of their size to give them right and proper what they saw was representation there. And it was so bitter and argumentative that the convention began to break up, and some of the delegates actually packed up and went home. Just simply left, took their bags with them. Benjamin Franklin, at that time, president of Pennsylvania, what was effectively the governor, was the title of the day, hosted the rest of the delegates that attended the convention, and he was the senior member at 81 years of age. He commanded the respect of those who were present. And James Madison records a moment in crisis where he stood up and addressed the group that remained. He said, "Mr. President, the small progress we have made after 4 or 5 weeks, attending here closely, reasoning with each other, the different sentiments that are on almost every question, several of the last have produced as many no's as yeses, I think is a melancholy proof of the imperfection of human understanding." Now, I'm leaving out some of the old English that was in the actual record word for word, but I'm giving you the sense of what was said. "We indeed seem to feel our own want of political wisdom since we have been running around in search of it. We have gone back to ancient history for models of government. We've examined different forms of the republics which have been formed by the seeds which being formed with seeds of their own dissolution. They had in them a flaw so significant which caused them to disappear after they were formed. They no longer exist. We have viewed modern states all around Europe, and we find none of their constitutions suitable to our circumstances. In this situation of this assembly, groping as it is in the dark to find political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not once thought to humbly apply to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard. They were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of superintending providence in our favor. To that kind providence, we owe this happy opportunity to consult in peace on the means of establishing our future national facility. And we have now, and have we now forgotten that powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance?" You know, Benjamin Franklin is trying to direct the convention back to God, saying, do we imagine that we as human beings on our own are sufficient to produce what it is that needs to be done? And he was directing them back to that. "I have lived, sir, a long time. The longer I live, the more convincing proof I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, it is probable that an empire cannot arise without his aid. We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this. And I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our partial local interests, our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down in future ages. What is worse, mankind may hereafter from this unfortunate instance despair of establishing government by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest. I therefore beg leave to move and henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessing on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of this city be requested to officiate in service. And there was an enormous and positive response. There was a fundamental change in the course of that Congress at that time. They requested certain matters of sermons to be preached and prayers to be offered. And it says, the clergy of the city responded to the request then by the Congress itself. And this effected a profound change in the convention, as noted in Jonathan Dayton's records when they reconvened on July 2nd, 1787. So we assembled again, and every unfriendly feeling had been expelled, and a spirit of conciliation had been cultivated. The attitude and tenor, the tone of the entire convention therefore changed. You know, I look back at the United Church of God as it was being founded, and the description of how often the discussions began to break down, and they would stop and pray, or they would leave and pray and come back and return, and they would begin to advance again. Brethren, we must remember that God not only rules in the kingdom of men, but that he rules even more so among his own people, his people who are called to put him first. And we must remember that it is not by our power of our hands or our intellect or thought or by the abundance of our blessings or the resources we have at hand, but it is by God's own power over which these things be done. Our blessings, our increase, our opportunity comes directly from God. In 2 Chronicles, chapter 7, there's a passage that I think it's significant in this regard, verse number 12. Solomon dedicated the temple that was built to God. And it was a magnificent temple. And you know, I like temples. I don't mean temples to God. I like things. I like buildings and beauty and landscape. I like things that are nice. And I look around and sometimes when I see those crumbling or misused or abused or set aside, it kind of tears and tugs at my own heart. God doesn't care about temples. He cares about the heart of man. But in verse number 12 here, 2 Corinthians 7, the Lord appeared to Solomon by night and said, I have heard your prayer, and I have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. Because Solomon had turned himself and directed his people toward God, God says, okay, I will accept this temple for me as a place of sacrifice. When I shut up heaven and there is no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, and send pestilence among my people, if my people who are called by my name, and you can hear the song that we hear at the feast so many times in special music, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face. You know what humble means? The root word in the Latin is humus. Humble means earth. If they'll come down to earth, that is our place on this earth. God is in heaven and we're on earth. And so when it talks about humbling yourself, it's like you're down there in the dirt and you're looking up because God is up there in heaven, and you must keep perspective as who we are and who he is. If my people will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, I'll forgive their sin, I will heal their land. very, very dramatic here. You know, God offers us so many blessings. He offers us so many gifts. Gifts that are only obtained miraculously through God. God's divine intervention. A gift of being able to be effective and to teach. I can get up here and I can entertain you. I can tell jokes. I can use color. I can use a lot of words and information, and I can raise and lower my voice and gesture, and I can tell you things that are interesting to you. I cannot inspire you. I do not have the power to do that. God has that power. And so all I can do apart from God is to go through empty temporary motions which have no long-term purpose at all. But by the power of God, you can be inspired. You can be encouraged to put Him first. And that is something that God Himself then does. Now, He does it through us in different ways. But God is saying here, Solomon, you built a great temple and a great house. And He says, that's fine. I accept that. But what I want is my people to humble themselves before Me and look to Me as God. And I will be their God. And they will be my people. And then it goes on in verse 17. As for you, if you walk before Me as your father David walked, and do according to all that I have commanded you, if you keep My statutes and judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom, as I covenanted with David your father, saying, you shall never fail to have a man as a ruler in Israel. But if you turn away and forsake My statutes and My commandments which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will uproot them from the land that I have given them, and this house which I have sanctified for My name I will cast out of My sight. I'll make it a proverb and a byword among all nations. The downfall will be so dramatic of God's people if they turn from Him, that it will be a byword spoken of by all the nations. Can you believe it? Why, that's like the man on the moon. That's, you know, something so dramatic and so unbelievable that it becomes simply a matter of example, even in the speech of the world around us. God says, if you obey Me, I will bless you. If you turn away from Me and set aside My law, I will take you out. That's an incredible thing to contemplate in the midst of all that we see and have and enjoy and the blessings of this land. Leviticus 26. Blessings and cursings. Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, but in this case the first. Basically is addressing in some ways the same thing. Verse number 3, if you walk in My statutes and keep My commandments and perform them, then I will give you rain in season. The land shall yield its produce, the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last till the time of vintage, and the vintage shall last till the time of sowing. And you shall eat bread to the full and dwell in your land safely. I'll give you peace in the land, so you will lie down, and none will make you afraid, because I'll rid the land of the evil beasts. And the sword will not go through your land. You will chase your enemies, and they shall fall by the sword before you. 5 of you shall chase 100. 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. Your enemies shall fall by the sword before you. And it just goes on and on. And God says, I will favor you. I will make you fruitful. I will curse those who are your enemies. And I will set your hand against them. It goes on and basically says, you know, your home will be a home that I bless. Your work will be a place that I bless. Your hand will be a hand that I bless in all that you do. And then in verse 14, but if you do not obey Me and do not observe these commandments and despise My statutes, if your soul abhors My judgments, so that you do not perform My commandments and break My covenant, I will do this to you. I will appoint terror over you. I will take away your peace, and now you will be afraid. Wasting disease and fever will consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart. You will sow your seed in vain. Your enemies will eat it. I will set my face against you, and you'll be defeated by your enemies. Those who hate you will reign over you, and you shall flee when no one pursues. And again, we can apply that to where we live, where we work, and what we do, because we are God's people, and God in principle shows that he will bless the work of our hands, or he will curse the work of our hands. I know that doesn't account for every single test or trial or circumstance we face. But God in principle shows us that he indeed will be with us if we are indeed with him. It goes on in verse number 19. If you look at this in a national sense, you could look at it in a personal sense, but if you look at it in a national sense, it is so significant. I will break the pride of your power. I will break your willingness to save and utilize and to rule among the nations of men. You will no longer, even the power that is there, you will no longer use it to advantage. Panama Canal was turned over to Panama yesterday. The operating company now, as I understand it, is Chinese. Former President Jimmy Carter went down there and handed that canal to them. At the time that treaty was made, some terrorists were making threats against the canal and us if we didn't give it to them and let them have this thing for their own personal use. And the great nation of the United States turned and simply gave it away. Even Derek said the other day, because they've had programs on TV, he says, Daddy, there's people died building that. People died, and look at the work that went into it, and they gave it away. And they gave it to what one day very possibly will be our enemy. It's just unbelievable. Now, I realize that we have not been a just people, that we have made treaties and broke them. We've made promises that we did not keep. But God has allowed a country as small and weak and frankly as insignificant as Panama to lift themselves up against us and to triumph in this way. God says, if you disobey me, I will break the pride of your power. And frankly, it just about nauseates me to even focus on what here has taken place. Do you realize that we never lost any battles in Vietnam? Or we might have lost a particular firefight, but any series of battles or any offensive, we never lost one. Even the Tet Offensive, which was so famous in that war, we almost annihilated the North Vietnamese regulars and the Viet Cong that attacked our soldiers and our troops. Some of their units were so savaged by the losses of the men and soldiers and equipment that they were almost entirely destroyed. And yet, whose courage was it that failed? Theirs or ours? Can you imagine your courage failing if you never lost a battle and you walk away from the war? Now, I'm not even accounting for should we be there, should we not be there. What I'm talking about, the will to carry out what you've set your mind to do. To win consistently and constantly and turn around and turn tail and run. And today, when we fight our wars, imagine that in Kosovo. I'd like to see a figure for how much it costs to take out every single tank on the ground. Because we took planes in this nation and hired crews and paid for planes to refuel them and loaded them with bombs, flew them all the way to Kosovo, dropped the bombs at 15,000 feet so that we could try for a tank once in a while, and then flew it all the way home. I'd like to know what the cost effectiveness of that approach to war was going to be. I think it would absolutely blow our minds because the pride in our power, even though we exercise it, we are afraid to go out and put this nation on the line. And so we try to do things in a sanitary, in a convenient, in a distant, in some kind of a way which is, to me, absolutely unbelievable. I have never heard one word on the news, in briefings, or in the paper, or journals. I have not heard one word of the effective cost of what was done in that war. Nobody has so much as ever even brought it up. God said, I will break the pride in your power. Why do little countries threaten and bully and push us around? Because they do not have fear of the consequences that would be indeed in place if we were obeying God and serving Him and willing to go where it is that we believe He should in us. We live in an unbelievable time. On the one hand, we have unparalleled prosperity. At the same time, we have unprecedented ungodliness and sin. And the critical issue for us, brethren, is to maintain a godly perspective in that midst. Not to become enamored with what we can see and taste and feel, but to maintain a godly perspective in the midst. 2 Peter 3 addresses this flesh and this physical life and all that can be accomplished therein. 2 Peter 3 and verse number 10. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, the elements will melt with fervent heat, both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these great, wonderful things which we have the ability to produce and create are going to be destroyed and come to nothing, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. God says, don't ever lose perspective in the midst of all the abundance and the opportunity that is there. Don't ever lose perspective on what really must come first. And what warning is it fundamentally we are given in that regard? When Daniel... When other prophecies talk about the time of the end, when prophecies down in the book of Genesis look back and say, what's going to happen in the end time? And then you go and look at Revelation 3, and you go to the end of the progression of the church, and Perry Miller addressed some matters in regard to this recently in Spokane. When he spoke about the Laodicean church in Revelation 3, what does it say? It describes a church that apparently is enamored with the production and the riches of its day. And yet the object obviously is spiritual, and intention needs to be spiritual. And God says, don't lose your focus. You think you're rich and increased with goods. You think you have what you need. And God says, you are poor, blind, and naked spiritually. They are not poor, blind, and naked physically. Physically, they apparently have everything you could ever want. Those things are going to be destroyed. Now, God works with us even more than He ever worked with the rest of physical Israel. We are His people spiritually. He's calling us to salvation now. He's calling us to be blessed now, physically and spiritually, as His providence does allow. And therein must be our focus. The physical can be taken away and will, but that which is spiritual will go on forever. Brethren, I believe the last 100 years was absolutely dramatic. But when you read the Word of God and look at our place in history and God's plan, you can be assured the next 100 years is going to be even more dramatic yet. I can't give you a date, you can't give me one. We understand that. But let there be no confusion in our minds that these things are taking place with those which are prophesied, and God rules in the kingdom of men. We need to keep that very high in our focus. And we need to make sure in the course of that we are always putting God first.